In Matthew chapter 5, again, is our text this morning. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. We're coming now toward the end of the introduction of Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. And in this introduction, Jesus whets your appetite for true life, true happiness, while at the same time preparing you to receive it through seemingly paradoxical statements. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and so forth. Jesus is opening you up to kingdom righteousness by showing you the kingdom reality, how life really works in light of his kingdom. So we've been asking this question: do you want to be a follower of Jesus? It's a simple question, but a crucial one. Do you want to be a follower of Jesus? Jesus is inviting you to that. It is the way to have a blessed life, the true fulfillment of everything you were made for. But it also challenges you, your perception of what life is all about. The next question we've been asking ourselves as we were walking through this is, what does it really mean then to be a follower of Jesus? If we say, yes, this is blessed, this is good, what does that mean? And now coming to our text, following on the heels of the final beatitude, which of course told us that we are blessed if we are persecuted for Christ's sake. Jesus lays out here a challenge before you to embrace what it really means to be one of his followers. So here is what you are called to as one of his followers. And like a master teacher that he is, by the way, before we read this, Jesus takes two things that are so common to your existence, everyday sorts of things, and he uses them to set the stage before you for what it means to follow him. In fact, this little section of the Sermon on the Mount provides some phrases, some sayings that word pictures, you might even call them, that have become so common in our language that people who've never even read the Bible recognize them. Things like salt of the earth, light of the world, city set on a hill. These kinds of things are simply just part of our language now. But they come from Jesus' teaching here. Let's listen to Jesus now and learn what he has to say. You, starting in verse 13, are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under men's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. You are salt and light, first of all. With these two very simple parallel statements, Jesus sets before you what his followers are. You are salt, the salt of the earth. You are light. You are the light of the world. But before we consider them, I think we need to pay attention to a point of emphasis that Jesus makes in the text here. And it's in that word, you. You. The way Jesus puts these statements in the original, there's a bit of an emphasis thrown upon that word, you. And it's important to note that this word is plural. You. All of you. Or if you're from down south, y'all. Right? The whole of you together is what he's talking about. And Jesus does two things by throwing this emphasis right here at the beginning. First, and we should note this, he gets very personal. He begins to draw his attention and direct his sermon right to you. Before it's been, this is truth, blessed are, blessed are, blessed are. But now he's honing in as he's coming into the sermon. And he looks right at his listeners and says, you. And this is important. You cannot listen to Jesus without being forced to respond to him in one way or another. You cannot hear him and then come away saying, oh, that was a really nice talk, but that doesn't really have anything to do with me. You're going to have to respond to Jesus, either by receiving his words and obeying them or rejecting them. And then secondly, Jesus identifies a distinct community here of his people as over against the earth or the world. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Pardon me. There's an alternative society here with a distinct identity. So Jesus is speaking corporately when he says, you all are the salt of the earth. You all are the light of the world. So what kind of a community is this group of disciples of Jesus? Well, this is what he talks about in these pictures here, salt and light. You are, first of all, salt. You are salt. What does that mean? You might start running through your mind about, well, what is salt like? What do we use salt for? And certainly, probably even this very day already, you have used salt. You use salt for flavoring or seasoning, to make the flavor of your food come out. You use salt for purifying. Has anybody in here ever gargled with salt water when you had a sore throat? Right? Why did you do that? Because, you know, salt has a purifying effect. It can kill those germs. Use salt for preserving. Say when you can pickles or other things you might do. Use salt to preserve things. Salt is very useful. And in fact, ancient people of Jesus' day, use salt in all the same ways that you have used them. Use salt in your life. They use salt for flavor. They use salt for purifying. They use salt for preserving things. Salt's a very useful item. So without even thinking too hard, we can already have a general idea of the implications Jesus is talking about when he says, you are the salt of the earth. You, the community of the followers of Jesus, you are to have a seasoning, purifying, preserving effect on the earth. Instead of a disgusting or putrefying or decaying effect on the earth, you are salt. But I think there's another sense, another use of salt in the history of God's dealings with his people, which is important here in our text that we need to pick up on. In Exodus chapter 30, salt is used in the incense which was to be placed before the Lord in the tabernacle. That was one of the specific ingredients that God taught his people to use. In Leviticus 2, salt was to season all the grain offerings which were given to the Lord. And in that text, the Lord specifically instructs, you shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. They were required to offer salt with these grain offerings, these food offerings before the Lord. And it's probably because of the very qualities of salt that we thought about just a minute ago. Salt was associated with then the covenant between God and his people, shown in the sacrifices. But even in Numbers 18, the Lord gave to the priests and the Levites to eat from the offerings of the Israelites, saying this, all the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord, I give to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. It is a covenant of salt forever, before the Lord, for you and for your offspring with you. Now, why do I take just a minute here to bring out some of that Old Testament background? Because I think it's actually present in some of these New Testament uses where Jesus begins talking about salt. If we look over in Mark chapter 9, verses 49 through 50, after saying this, that it's better for you to be crippled or maimed and to go to heaven than to end up in hell, Jesus says this, for everyone will be salted with fire. Everyone will be salted with fire. What are we to think of that? He's drawing on that Old Testament sacrificial imagery there. And alluding to the Old Testament sacrifices, Jesus is saying that discipleship following him is sacrificial. You are to be a sacrifice. And then Jesus says, the following verse, salt is good. But if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. If discipleship is sacrificial, if everyone who would be Christ's disciple must yield up his life as a living sacrifice, what does that look like? Well, being his disciple, then he says in verse 50, being salty works out in the peaceful relationships with one another. Pardon me. Be at peace with one another. Peaceful relationships in communion before the face of God. As the Jews would have understood, this is exactly how we enjoy that relationship of fellowship with God through these offerings. We have communion with God and peace then with one another. Jesus is drawing on that very truth. Again, in Luke 14, Jesus applies this concept of salt to being his disciple. So therefore, if any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, does this sound familiar, by the way? He's saying the same thing he's saying in our text, right? But here it's particularly in the context of being his disciple. Anyone who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. You're to become that sacrificial salt. By the way, the Apostle Paul also picks up on this. He tells us that we are to walk in wisdom toward outsiders in Colossians chapter 4, which includes speech that is gracious, and he says there, seasoned with salt. Salt is the seasoning of being at peace with God, as those grain offerings would have shown, being purified, being preserved, and in covenant with him, communicating that effect then in our wise living, in our wise speaking. I think with this enriched understanding, then, we come back to our text. Christ says, you are the salt of the earth. Christ's followers are the purifying, preserving agent, which in a sense presents the whole earth as a sacrifice pleasing and acceptable, well-seasoned to God. Your purifying, preserving presence on the earth today is a salting of the earth. Now, Jesus gives us another picture right in parallel with that to help us draw this out more. You are the light of the world. You notice in our reading of 1 John 1 this morning, we read that God is light. God is light. And that all of those who claim that relationship with him are to walk in the light as he is in the light. Several years ago, when we were studying 1 John 1:5, we said that when John says God is light, we see that our God is all goodness and life and blessing. In him, there is no cold barrenness, isolated selfishness, ugliness, destruction, and death. Also, when John says God is light, we see that our God is all righteousness, holiness, and purity. In him, there is no sinfulness, lawlessness, corruption, decay, evil, wickedness at all. And also, when God says he is light, we see that our God is all truth, absolute knowledge, intelligence, and wisdom. In him, there is no error, lies, ignorance, deception, or confusion at all. There is no darkness in him. That very light of God was shined into the world in no other way than in Jesus Christ himself. He is the light of the world. But amazingly, now in this text, as Jesus talks to you, his followers, he says, you are the light of the world. That light of Jesus Christ now shines through all who follow him. So, to borrow the words of another man, that the community of followers of Jesus shines with purity as opposed to filth, truth or knowledge as opposed to error or ignorance, and divine revelation and presence as opposed to reprobation and abandonment by God. The world is in darkness. This is the darkness of sin. Did you catch that in Psalm 112 that we read together? Light is shown for the righteous, right? Here's what walking with God is like, because he is light. Pardon me. The world is walking in darkness of sin. People are wandering here and there, looking for fulfillment in relationships, Nations struggle within and with each other, looking for some kind of direction. Educators grope about here and there for some kind of truth that will guide their endeavors. The world is in darkness. Where are they to see Christ's light? Where are they supposed to be able to come to grips with, be confronted with the light of God? In the community of Christ's followers. You are a community which gives the light of Christ's life and purity and truth to the world. That's what Jesus is saying here. So, you all together are light and salt. And it's with these two images that Jesus introduces you to what it means to follow him. I've been showing you this is a blessed condition, even if your natural perception doesn't see what it means to be a follower of Jesus. But he says, here, let me begin to introduce you to this. You are salt, you are light. But each of these two ways of describing Christ's followers brings with it obvious implications. And that's the next point that our text brings out here. One is more of a warning, and one is a command. You are salt and light. So what follows from that? Don't lose your saltiness and shine your light. Don't lose your saltiness, he says. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under men's feet. Don't lose your saltiness, which is as much as to say, don't be foolish and fail to follow Jesus. Now, let me give you a little bit here of a, I guess you might call it a little bit of a strange translation of this verse here. If the salt becomes foolish, by what shall it be made salty? If the salt becomes foolish, by what shall it be made salty? Now that sounds strange, but it's actually legitimate. Because the word for foolish here, the word for lost its taste here, I should say, is really a word that means foolish. It and all the related words around it, almost all the time they're used, simply mean foolish. For example, you'll find this very verb in Romans 1:22, where people who reject God think themselves to be wise, and they do what? Become fools. Or 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20. God has made foolish the wisdom of this world. That's the exact same term that we find in our text here. There's only two times in the whole Bible where we find this translated with something like, it's lost its taste or become tasteless or dull. And that other one is in Luke 14 in the same exact context, salt losing its saltiness. So in this context, in the context of salt losing its saltiness, your English Bible translations are not wrong for translating it if the salt has lost its taste. We can see exactly why they would translate it that in that context. But I do think that Jesus uses a word related to foolishness here on purpose. For one thing, his whole sermon is going to conclude with a contrast between a wise man who hears his words and builds on that, who does them and builds on that foundation, and someone who hears his words but doesn't do what he says, and he's the foolish man, right? This whole sermon is a call to the life of wisdom versus the life of foolishness. Pardon me. And for another reason, this is implicit, really, this idea here is of being foolish is implicitly in contrast with being salty. To be salty, as Paul already recognized in Colossians 4, means to be wise, living in according to God's eternal kingdom. Fools are too self-centered and too short-sighted to see that. They can't live in light of God's eternal kingdom. They only see the here and now. So Jesus is talking about foolishness. Salt, which has become unsalty or foolish in this sense, is worthless. If the salt has lost its taste, if it's become unsalty, what are you going to do? By what means can you make it salty again? It cannot be done. That's the point. Now, some who think that they're smarter than the Bible sometimes criticize this particular passage for saying salt becoming unsalty. Salt can't do that. That sodium chloride compound, chemists tell us, is a pretty stable compound. Wherever you find it, it's going to be salt. It's not going to be something else. But of course, in Jesus' day, as people used salt, which was harvested from various means, it was typically impure and mixed with other compounds. And sometimes the very saltiness of it would be leached out. And therefore, what you'd have left was not really salty at all, but all the other stuff that had been with the salt when you got it. That's exactly what Jesus is just alluding to, their common everyday experience of having salt that then became unsalty. They didn't accomplish the purposes of salt anymore. Pardon me. And so it is for those would-be followers of Jesus who do not live according to his eternal kingdom. They become unsalty, which is to say, they become worthless. They do not accomplish the purposes that God has followers of Jesus, a community of Jesus in this world for. It's to be thrown out and implicitly judged, trampled under men's feet. That is what they're worth, or what they're worthwhile for. So that's the warning. If you are salt, don't lose your saltiness. If you are light, then shine your light. Here's the command in verse 14. You are the light of the world. Pardon me. Shine your light. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all that are in a house. In the same way, let your light shine before men. Shine your light. Which is to say, live the life of the kingdom before the watching world. Shine out that light. Jesus explains it in verses 14 and 15 here, that the whole reason people do these things that show light is so that it can be visible. Why would you lay out a city, found a city, on the top of a hill? There may be a number of reasons, but one thing, it's visible. Right? You can see it. You can find it. It cannot be hidden, actually. By the day as the sun shines, or by the night when the lights are on in it, you will see that city. That's the point. Same way, would people light a lamp in their house and then put it under a basket? Of course, a lamp in that day would have been basically been just like a bowl of oil with a wick in it that you would use in your house to light with. But would you take that then? In fact, Jesus may even be pointing to these kinds of items here as it kind of is implied in the original. Here's a lamp. Would you take that, light it, and then go take this bowl or this basket that you use to measure your grain in, maybe about a peck in our day, and then take it and stick it underneath that? What would have been the point of even lighting the lamp in the first place? Nobody does that kind of a thing, right? That doesn't make any sense. Well, that's the point. If God calls out followers of Jesus Christ in this world, what's the point? Is it to hide them then? Is it to make them invisible to everybody else so they don't know they're there? No, it's exactly the opposite. It's to let it shine out. In fact, it's to let the light of Christ shine out. Let your light shine. The whole reason Jesus calls out a community of followers in this dark world is so that his light can be seen. And then, of course, Jesus drives this point home. Shine your light before men so that they may see your good works and glorify, praise, honor, worship your Father in heaven. Now, of course, just Jesus saying that. Let your light shine before men so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven raises one interesting question. What are the good works? What are the good works in light of the reality of the kingdom of heaven that we've been learning about? What are good works? Well, that's the real righteousness that Jesus is going to expound on in the rest of the sermon, but we won't get there today. All right? He's going to teach us what real righteousness is. But we can see already here at least two important things, and I want you to take these to heart. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? It means that you do good works, right? That's just bound up in it. It's part and parcel of it. This is what you do. This is why God creates this community of followers of Jesus, why Jesus came and called them forth to follow him. So their light would shine, they would do good works, and others would glorify our Father in heaven. You are salt and light. There's no way to be that apart from good works. Now, pardon me. Some people hear that and think, well, that sounds a lot like Roman Catholicism to me, right? Isn't the whole point of, say, Protestantism to say, as opposed to Roman Catholicism, Catholicism says you do good works. That's how you be a good person and be right with God. And Protestantism says, no, good works aren't anything to do with this. They have nothing to do with your relationship to God. You just trust Jesus. And sometimes it's a popular conception of the difference, you might say, between the two. Roman Catholicism says you have to do this. Protestantism says, no, it's already done for you. You don't have to do anything. That's not quite right. Unfortunately, there has arisen some teaching, even within Protestant circles, that does say good works have nothing to do with your relationship to Jesus Christ. Of course, one of the obvious problems with that is it's really hard to listen to Jesus Christ and come away with that idea that good works have nothing to do with being a follower of Jesus. He just said here, you are the light of the world. The whole way you show that is by doing good works. Now, are there important distinctions to be made, even in those historical terms we're just talking about, say, Catholicism, Protestantism, those various things? Yes, there are important things, and in fact, they will come out more and more, even as we look at this sermon. But it's so important that you just grasp right now that free grace in Jesus Christ does not mean it doesn't matter how you live, right? It has nothing to do with the kind of life that you live. That's completely false. And it's not what Jesus is talking about here at all. In fact, to put it in more Pauline terms, the free grace of Jesus Christ is what enables true good works. But this is important. Take this to heart. To be a follower of Jesus means you do good works. Let's just stop even at this point in the sermon, even though we haven't taken time to expound on or hear Jesus expound on all that this means to this greater righteousness. Right away, you know up front here. And remember, you can't listen to Jesus without doing something about what he says. You know right up front that following Jesus is going to demand a certain way of life. It is going to demand that. And I would just submit to you here today, if you're going to listen to Jesus and say, yes, I want to be a follower of Jesus, it's going to change your life. It has to. This is the whole point for which Jesus accomplishes this. Let me take just a second brief point here that I want you to take to heart at this point in the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus says, in the same way, let your light shine before men so they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven, this means that the whole goal of being a community of followers of Jesus is to glorify your Father in heaven. That's why there is such a thing as a community of followers of Jesus. Let's just think about how that applies to us as a church right now. What does that mean our purpose is as a church? Why are we existing? Why are we meeting here together today? Maybe I can sharpen the point a little bit by saying it this way. Our point in meeting together today isn't to meet your needs. That really isn't the ultimate goal. Now, we will find that as God is glorified, that is truly what meets our needs. But if we approach the community of followers of Jesus with the idea that this really is about me, I need this. I need friends. I need good teaching to help me out in life so I do the right things and don't get into a bunch of trouble. And really, I'll gather. I'll be considered a part of Jesus' followers as long as it suits what I think my needs are, right? Because that's actually what this is all about. Really, it's about me. No, that really isn't what it's all about. And anybody who approaches being one of Jesus' followers has to stop right at this point and say, you are salt, you are light. And what does that mean? That means the whole point of what God is accomplishing here ultimately transcends us. It's about giving glory to God. Why would we take time this morning to gather together, even to preach God's word? Now, isn't that something that benefits us? Very much so. But what is the ultimate objective of this? It's to glorify God. It's so his truth is proclaimed in the world. So the world comes to acknowledge him as Lord, to submit to him, to worship him. That's why we're here. That's why our singing, by the way, is an intrinsic part of what we're doing together. You ever think it's interesting that God set up his followers to get together and sing? That is something the Holy Spirit produces when he calls people to Jesus Christ and unites them to him. He produces a people who sing. One of the things that tells us is that church is not just about an instruction manual, right? And I should judge the value of my church experience by what I got out of the sermon, so to speak. Church isn't just a sermon. It's not just communicating information or tips on how to live well or things like that. It's much bigger than that. And that's why singing is intrinsically a part of it. That's why praying is a part of this. Our total dependence upon God, our calling upon him to accomplish his good purposes. It's why our communion together actually is all a part of this. You notice that you all, you community, are the salt and the light in this world. The whole goal of being a community of followers of Jesus is to glorify your Father in heaven. And so now with that introduction completed, yes, I know we've taken several sermons to go through Jesus' introduction, but that's just the introduction to the sermon. With that introduction to the sermon completed, you need to be asking yourself, am I willing to listen to what Jesus has to say? He has invited me to true fulfillment, blessedness, true happiness, really the fulfillment of everything I could ever desire. But it's going to mean something that I don't naturally think. It's going to mean being poor in spirit, mourning, being meek, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being merciful, pure in heart, a peacemaker, and persecuted for righteousness' sake. It's going to mean, in a sense, putting aside my life as I see it in the here and now, and learning to see it wisely in light of the coming kingdom of heaven. Am I willing to do that? Am I willing to make my life all about not myself, but about pursuing the glory of God? That's what Jesus is asking you to listen for here. If not, without being willing to do that, you'll never really understand what this true righteousness is that he's going to be expounding to us. You'll look at it from a fleshly perspective. You'll look at it from a worldly perspective, and you'll think it's just the same thing as all the other good things other people do in the world, or all the other religions do in the world. That's not what Jesus is trying to give to us here. He's not saying, here's this good life, this righteousness that everybody in the world really gets. All religions work toward that good, and we're just all on the same path, and I'm going to give you a good way to get there. It's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying, I'm going to show you what true good is. But here's the only way you'll see it. So listen. Listen carefully. And ask yourself today, are you willing to follow? Are you willing to follow? If you would say right now, yes. Before God and men, I want to follow Jesus and to receive what that means. For me, for our whole church, for all the followers of Jesus, and ultimately for the whole world. Would you confess your faith that Jesus is Lord? Let's do it together as a congregation. Jesus is Lord. Amen. Let's look to him now in prayer.